You are listening to a podcast from the UBC School of Journalism.
Thanks, everyone, for coming on a rather dreary, wet day to listen to a fantastic speaker and journalist. It's my privilege to welcome Carl Zimmer, who's been described by the New York Times Book Review as as fine a science essayist as we have. He's written across media platforms, books, blogs for the New York Times, won a numerous awards, and he's going to actually outline his trajectory and how he got to where he is in part of his discussion today. We're going to make this very informal, so Carl's going to talk for a while, share his story, and then please ask as many questions as possible. So please join me in welcoming Carl Zimmer.
Thanks. I thought I would just kind of tell you a little bit about how I got involved in science writing and got to the point where I am now, because when I started in science writing, it was a very different world. I've been doing this for 19 years. When I was in college, I was an English major, I was always interested in science, but I didn't really put the two together. I'm not sure why. But in any case, I was interested in science, interested enough to be like in a physics class, not because I had to be in a physics class, which was the case for everybody else around me, all the pre-meds and the engineers. So they didn't know what to make of me. I wish I took more science classes in hindsight, but they were all at 8 in the morning and they were up this hill and I just had my different priorities. But in any case, I was doing a lot of writing, writing fiction, interning at a newspaper, just doing all sorts of stuff. So I knew I wanted to do something having to do with writing. I just didn't know what. After college, I did a bunch of different things, worked as a carpenter for a while, worked in an environmental group, so on. But I was still continuing my writing, and after a while I thought maybe I could get a job on staff at a magazine, just an entry-level kind of job. Again, wasn't thinking clearly about science or anything like that. How do I put this? I mean, you guys are showing a lot more foresight about your careers than I did. So you can take everything I say with a grain of salt. But in any case, I got a job. I was lucky to get a job as a fact checker. As a copy editor initially at Discover Magazine, an American science magazine. And I turned out to be a terrible copy editor. But they took pity on me and let me do fact-checking instead, which was a wonderful experience and a really great way to learn about how science journalism works, because you get a feature that's been edited. It's written perhaps by one of the country's best science writers, and then it's up to you to make sure that it's all correct. So you actually have to sort of follow in their footsteps and read the things they read and talk to people they talk to, and you discover how mistakes creep in to these things. How people, how people assemble stories and the mistakes that they make, even when they're, you know, the best in the country. After that, I began to start to write pieces, short pieces at first, and then longer ones. And then longer still. And I was also starting to do some editing. Eventually I was editing features, and I tended to work a lot with the scientists who would write for Discover. We sort of have a mix of science writers and scientists, and I would try to work with the scientists to get them to write in plain English, which is not very easy. At Discover, I really prized the chance to write, and so while other editors, I ended up being a senior editor there, and other editors really were focusing on being editors, on planning out the issues for the future, and working really closely with a lot of writers and so on. I um, I kind of was a 50-50 editor. So I would spend half my time writing and half my time editing. There came a point where I would be writing features, and the features would come out, and I would get a little frustrated because, I'll give you an example of how I would become frustrated. So I wrote a piece about how our ancestors came out of the water onto land. And so I was focusing on some relatively new fossils that had been discovered in Greenland, of these bizarre fish-like creatures with 8 fingers. And it was a big story. 7 or 8 pages long in the magazine. It was big for a magazine story. And yet, I when it came out, I was sort of paging through it, and I was looking over at my desk at the folders of papers that I had amassed while working on this piece, and there was just so much that I had left out. So much history, so many different dimensions. So, there are paleontologists who study fossils to understand how we were transformed from fish. And there are actually developmental biologists who study embryos to discover how we evolved from fish. And then sometimes the paleontologists and the developmental biologists are the same people. None of that was in the piece. And I felt a little sad because I thought, well, how am I going to be able to write about this? I mean, this is interesting. So that compelled me to start thinking more seriously about books. And so I wrote my first book in 1998. Well, the first book was published in 1998, and it was called At the Water's Edge. And so it was actually about how life came out of the water, and then later how some forms of life, like whales, went back in. And so in that case, I was sort of expanding on these magazine articles I had written. And then in other cases, actually, I arranged to write additional magazine articles that had some bearing on the stuff I wanted to work on for the book. And fortunately, my editors were perfectly happy with that. So I wrote a piece about how dolphins swim. Because if you're a mammal on land, walking around, and then you evolve to be kind of like a fish again, but you've still got this mammal body, metabolism, and all that, there's a lot of awkwardness involved. You have instead of gills, you have a blowhole. You're still warm-blooded, so you're going to overheat, or you might radiate all your heat out if you're not properly insulated. It's complicated. So I did an article on the mystery of how whales and dolphins survive in the water. So that book came out in 1998, and then I started working on another book because that was a lot of fun. And so my second book was about parasites, about how parasites are incredibly neglected and denigrated, and yet they're incredibly interesting and hugely important in life. I mean, most life is a parasite, simple enough. And it was sort of during that time that I decided to, I was coming on like, I guess, 8 or 9 years at Discover, and I was starting to get a bit restless, writing for one place in the same kind of style. And there were other places that I was interested in writing for, and I had, another book I was working on. And so I decided just to take a plunge and to go freelance. So I did that 10 years ago, and it's worked out well. I'm glad that I did that. Some people are really suited to working on staff as editors or staff writers at magazines or newspapers, and other people are suited to be freelancers, and I'm a freelancer type. I like working at home. I like going between a lot of different projects. I like working with a lot of different publications and different people there. Other people I know, really good writers or really good editors, just can't stand it. And they've tried it, and they've gone insane. And because they find it lonely, they find it much more satisfying to be working together with people, and they may just find it hard to like sit down at their desk at home and work. And it is true that some days you sit down at your desk at home, and all of a sudden you have this great urge to do the dishes or the laundry, like as if you ever cared about laundry, but somehow the laundry must get done. So at least you have clean clothes, but it's a problem. So when I started freelancing, I mean, I talked to people who freelance and talked to some various editors, and I basically it was pretty clear that to make it as a freelancer, you have to start working at a number of different places. So it's just like having a financial portfolio. You diversify your portfolio. Because if you have all your stock in Enron, and then Enron's gone, you're broke. So if you have one really strong, powerful relationship with one editor at one magazine, and then that editor decides that he wants to, wants to become a fisherman or whatever, you've got nobody else. And now all of a sudden you're going to have to spend a lot of time establishing a new contact with somebody else. So what I did is what a lot of freelancers do. I just started to make contact in a lot of different places. Now, it helped that I was myself a senior editor at a magazine, and so I already had interactions with people. So, for example, there were some editors who would freelance on the side for Discover, so I got to know them that way. So I could just say, hey, can I write something for you? And so I started to write for several different places, Discover still, but also Natural History Magazine and National Geographic and Science Magazine. Sort of the kind of stuff I was doing, still sort of magazine stuff. And that's sort of how I pursued things for a few years, but after a while, things started to branch out. So, for example, I was still working on books, I should mention, so I've written 7 now. Last one just came out, and so I was sort of balancing the magazine stuff with the books and sort of trying to figure out ways to make them kind of support each other. But then I got started writing for newspapers, particularly the New York Times. I just thought, I have a bunch of ideas, and I think that some of these would work well in a newspaper, and I really liked how the New York Times puts great emphasis on their science. They have a science section every Tuesday, and it's got great prominence and all. So I made contact, and fortunately the editor of the Science Times had read my book about parasites and liked it. So he already knew who I was and said, "Yeah, send some proposals my way." So then I have to think, like, okay, well, I'm writing for a newspaper, I'm not writing for a magazine now. And so a lot of the magazines I've been writing for were pretty specialized for science, but even though this is a science section in a newspaper, it's still a newspaper, and it's a large newspaper, it has a wide readership. So I started to think, like, well, you know, what would be something interesting to write about that would work there? It would have to be something that wouldn't be too long. So, for example, like a magazine feature may go 5,000-6,000 words. The longest that something in the Science Times will go would be 1,600 words, 1,800 words. That's a long piece. Regularly, you see 800 word pieces. So I was looking through journals and I think it was in September, I believe, and I happened to see a piece on this debate that's going on in botany circles about why leaves change color in the fall. And there's some beautiful, but still kind of speculative explanations that they might be like warning signals to insects not to lay their eggs on trees because they're going to make lots of toxins that will kill their offspring. But there are other ideas that it's just it's a way that the trees actually protect themselves, sort of like a sunscreen as fall comes. So that was one of my first pieces, and I proposed it, and they said great, because everybody knows that leaves change in the fall. So it's not like it's a very accessible thing. We had a huge piece of art on the cover of the Science Times, big bright orange leaves, and then a diagram showing the structure inside of leaves and how actually in the fall, as the temperature drops, it actually a lot of the sun can actually damage leaves. They can give them sunburn, which is pretty weird, and how they can protect themselves with these pigments. So that was my first story, and I've been working with them ever since, and I've really enjoyed the relationship with them, because I can write about natural history with them. I don't have to like write about news you can use or make some ridiculous stretch to a potential application for some kind of science when it's just interesting in and of itself, and they recognize that. So it's been a good relationship. So now we've got magazines, books, and newspapers. I've been slowly kind of accreting other things on top of that. So, for example, I set up a website in, I guess, 2000. And it was just a way of basically putting some clips in one place online, so that I didn't have. I mean, in the dark ages when I started, you would actually have to have a clip file. You would have to snip out the article from the magazine or the newspaper and like paste it on in a notebook, and then you would go and photocopy it and then send it to an editor with a proposal. It was crazy. It was medieval. And since it was relatively easy to set up a website at that point, I said, okay, I'm going to ask for permission to put the text of my articles on there. And then when I start working with people and they say, can I see something you've done? I say, yes, link, go. But that was still, there weren't many people doing it. And a lot of people thought I was pretty strange for this. I mean, they didn't see that as a way of, they didn't see the point. But then I said, I also have like a little section for my books and give information about books. So if people get interested in my books, maybe they'll buy a book. And, I can just keep adding this website as things go along. Fortunately, I was able to get a website with my own name. And so we set that up, and that's still running, but things obviously changed a couple years after that, when there was this software that came along that let you basically rapidly update websites. You could do this thing called a weblog or a blog. I started noticing people doing interesting things with blogs in science. This is 2003, 2004. So there's one writer named Chris Mooney who was actually sort of blogging the research for his book that he was writing at the time, and eliciting comments from his readers, asking questions and just bouncing ideas off of them. And I said, "Whoa, this is new. This is different. This is interesting." And so at the time, I just thought I wanted to get involved in that just as an experiment, just to try a different format. So I'm just sort of a restless person. So I just got a little restless at Discover, and I kind of moved on, and here was something else to sort of toy around with. You know, when you experiment with things, a lot of things end up being dead ends, but a few things actually turn out to be fruitful. So obviously, you know, blogging, just in general, turned out to be very fruitful. I mean, it is now just totally woven into the nature of journalism itself. I mean, so the New York Times now has, I can't even keep track of how many blogs they have. I don't know, 20 blogs or something like that. And I don't really know where they draw the line between their blogs and their reporting. I'm pretty sure there's a line still there, but it's getting smudged pretty seriously. And some of their best reporting appears on their blogs. It's confusing. I mean, so when one of the reporters was released from captivity in Afghanistan and wrote a really compelling first-person account of his experience, it was on his blog. He has a war blog there. And it was just great writing. So I started writing a blog. I started a blog just on my own called The Loom. And essentially, it was just a place where I could write stuff that I didn't think that I could get anywhere else. Kind of, you know, pursue my own little obsessions and write essays. So for essays actually had kind of been kind of, it's funny, essays had actually been kind of withering away. I wrote some essays for Natural History for a while. I was writing their essays about evolution, for example. And then they moved away from that, and so I didn't have the opportunity to do it, to be writing essays, and it didn't seem like there was any place where you could do it. And I really like, I mean, I think a science essay is a beautiful thing. So now I had a blog, I could do whatever I want, so I started writing essays. And it turns out that blogs actually have, just in general, have kind of revived the art of the essay, I think, in a big way. So lots of blog posts are just very elegant short essays. So the blog had, you know, so I started the blog on my own, and then eventually Seed Magazine asked me to join them. They have like 70 bloggers. They're one of the leading science blog sites. And then Discover, my old magazine, came to me and a year and a half ago and said, tell you what, how about you come blog for us? We'll give you a lot of special support. We're only going to have a handful of bloggers. We're going to put a real strong focus on you guys. And in addition, we want you to write a monthly column for us about the brain. How about that? That sounds great. So now I'm at Discover, back at Discover in a weird virtual way, with the blog and the column. And within the blog itself, there's a lot more opportunity to experiment with all sorts of things. I mean, the first time that I actually embedded a video in a blog post was just a wonderful moment. Now, of course, it's a sort of de rigueur, but I mean, again, to date myself, I wrote an article like in 1994 about biomechanics, about how animals move. And it was actually, so scientists had a pretty good idea of how vertebrates like horses move, but insects were a real mystery. And so there are these people in Berkeley who study how insects move, how cockroaches run and centipedes crawl and all that stuff. You know, they're painting the legs of an ant white so they can film them and figure out the forces. And it's just really cool stuff. And it's actually like helped to give rise to this whole blossoming industry of insect robots. They're the ones who figured out how insects move, and you just steal those biomechanic secrets and build yourself an insect robot, which are big business now. In any case, it was a real struggle because it's really hard to write about things like biomechanics. If you can just watch a movie, you get it right away. You know, the classic experiment with Edward Muybridge did in biomechanics was to see if horses lifted all their legs up at once. And he did this in the 19th century with a string of cameras on a horse track. And if you just watch those pictures in sequence, you see this little movie, which is really maybe the first movie, you see it. You can see all those legs coming up and then going back down again. Writing about it just on its own just isn't that satisfying. So I remember saying to an editor, wouldn't it be great, like, if instead of these photographs we have here, that there was like a video screen built into the magazine? And you might have said, yeah, right, it would be great. Well, get back to work. Well, now that exists. And I actually write, among other things, about biomechanics on the blog because these scientists have gorgeous digital video. And I'll just say, can you give that to me? And I'll put it on a site like Vimeo and then embed it in my blog. So I did something on bats, for example, how bats fly, and which is just a fascinating question on its own. Also, like, what happens if you're a bat and you land on the ground? You've got these legs have become wings. What do you do? Turns out vampire bats can walk around on the ground, and they can even run. And so you can go to my blog and check that out, that film out, because it's really creepy. But in any case, the film shows, I mean, it just gets across my point very easily, and it is a moving illustration. And it helps that they're just totally beautiful. So that's what I still, and so I still am trying to use blogs to just experiment with new ways of writing and communicating about science. So at this point, I'm sort of fooling around with other things as well at this point. So for example, I'm trying out podcasting. The American Society of Microbiology asked me to do a podcast for them, kind of a regular thing where I talk to scientists about viruses or bacteria or what have you that that are quite cool. And there's a guy here at UBC that we're making arrangements for me to talk to him soon. And that's a new challenge because, you know, when you're writing an article and you're interviewing a scientist, it's okay if 99% of what they say is just totally unquotable. If you can get one or two sentences from them, they're really, you know, clear and beautiful. You can quote them on that, and you can write the rest. On a podcast, on radio, it's like you've got to help them be eloquent. And so I'm learning how that works. But, you know, I don't know what's going to come next. I've been helping some people who do a radio show called Radiolab. I don't know if you ever listened to it, but it's a really wonderful show. It's mainly about science, and you know, I've just been enjoying coming in and recording with them just to sit there and watch them work and see how they take the same kind of things that I write about and turn them into sound. So, like, I wrote this piece about why we sleep. It was a piece I did for the Times. And they read it, and then they went to the same scientists and did their thing on it. But I don't see that as plagiarism or anything. I mean, because what they did is they went in and they did it their way. So one of the things that I was writing about is how scientists say, well, if we look at how different animals sleep, maybe we can figure out what sleep is for. Because some animals barely sleep at all, and some animals are barely awake at all. And so why is there that range? And maybe that range tells you something about what the function is in all animals, including us. Well, one of the ways that scientists study how animals sleep is to listen to them sleep. In other words, to put electrodes in and monitor their brainwave activity. So they played the sounds of waking animals and sleeping animals, different animals, and the sound is just hypnotic. It's very weird. Like, and it's something, obviously, that I couldn't do in a newspaper, but they, because they understand the strengths of radio, they go and look for the way that they can bring sound to a story and actually do things that you can't do in other formats. So I think the most extreme stretch I've had so far has been actually working with some people on a museum exhibit. So this is an exhibit that's about evolution, and it's in a number of state natural history museums in the U.S. and it shows a number of different sort of case studies in evolution. So whales with legs, Darwin's finches and their beaks changing size due to natural selection. And I was supposed to write the copy that goes on the wall next to these exhibits. And basically what they said was, okay, so your audience is some 10-year-old who's running through this room. Now, you've got about 50 or 100 words to stop him or her and to read what you have to say and get something out of it. And then probably just keep running. And that's tough. But it's a good experience because it forces you to really be simple and clear. perhaps more than you might have been otherwise. So really, that's sort of where things are with me now at this point. As you can see, things have changed a lot since when I started. I can try to prognosticate for you, but I'll probably be wrong. So maybe the best thing would be to just see what kind of questions you guys have and what we can talk about. Yeah.
I'll start. Thank you, that's fascinating, and you're very humble. Your work is fantastic. Credit for everything that you do. But one thing I want to ask, so you were giving a talk last night about your most recent book, right?
Mm-hmm.
Evolution. And like you just said, you were working on a museum exhibit and all that. Do you ever find yourself getting involved in kind of policy discussions or advocacy of how evolution is taught, or those kind of more social sides of the discussion about evolution? Mm-hmm. Or do you see yourself more as a person whose role it is just to describe the science in a beautiful and comprehensible way?
Yeah, so I'm not an advocate, I'm not saying that journalists cannot be advocates, but I certainly think that in the work that I do, being an advocate just would not make sense. It just wouldn't work. Because what I want to do is simply to find exciting, important new science and write about it and to figure out how to explain it and how to tell a story about it. That's what I do. Now, because I write about science like evolution, there are a number of people, I guess, who see that and think, "Oh my God, that's very controversial." I get emails from people who are praying for my soul because I'm going to go to hell and all that. So I end up kind of in the midst of some of these situations, but only because I'm just being a journalist. I just happen to be a journalist writing about a kind of science that a number of people don't want to acknowledge and think that threatens them in some deep way. It doesn't, but that's what they think. I don't get involved in like helping to set some sort of policy about how evolution should be taught. I don't get involved in I don't debate creationists. I've been asked to a couple times, but I just don't think that's that's just not my job description. On the other hand, there have been plenty of times where creationists have written very lengthy, very nasty attacks on me for something I've written. And I think, well, then that's the situation where I'm going to defend myself. I'm going to set the record straight. You know, if someone is accusing me of distortion or something like that, or misrepresenting science, I'm going to just show that actually I didn't, and that their arguments make no sense at all, and just point out how they have a very anti-scientific view. So I'll do. I tend to do that on my. That's one of the things my blog is for. You know, I'm not going to write an article about that for the Times or anything like that. There, I'll just keep it to the science. But you know, I do think that if you, I do think it's possible to through writing clearly about this, about evolution, and to convey to people the excitement, is a way to just. I mean, it just is a fact that people who may have felt somehow threatened by it will just actually turn around and become very fascinated by it. And I have you know, letters or emails from people to prove it. So you know, I'm glad that happens, and that's what I'm going to continue to do. Yes.
Sort of following up on that, even within sticking to the science, how much do you try and focus your stories on being newsworthy, on connecting up to what's in the rest of the newspaper, or are you just kind of separate from that and science is its own news?
I do like actually that the science is a bit separate from the news, because there is such a fixation on what somebody said about somebody else 5 seconds ago as if that's important. It's not really in the scheme of things. I mean, if you were to go back and look at, you know, the little sniping that might have taken place in a particular election 2 or 3 years ago, you might say, gosh, who cares? I mean, that itself was really not very important. Meanwhile, here were these scientists over here figuring out the nature of matter itself, or discovering a fossil that changes how we understand how we got to be this way. I think that science is newsworthy, but on a sort of a different scale than a lot of the news that you see in other parts of the newspaper. That being said, I do also like to. I enjoy writing articles about things that really have zero applicability or any connection to what's in the rest of the newspaper. So, I wrote an article about sexual cannibalism. Okay, not people. But praying mantises, spiders. I mean, it's a surprisingly widespread phenomenon where two animals are mating, and then the female just grabs the male and just starts devouring him. What is going on? It was pinned. To news, to it. There was a news hook to it, believe it or not. There was a new
Valentine's Day? No.
A new paper had been published in a prominent journal called American Naturalist where there was a new set of experiments to test a hypothesis for why this had evolved using praying mantises, and showed like a really interesting new pattern. That might help to explain how this keeps evolving. So in my world, you know, a new scientific paper, that's news. That's an opportunity to report on an interesting subject. But people are going to read that not because it's going to like somehow lower their cholesterol, but because they're curious. And because they see praying mantises in their garden. And then they take a look at these fantastic photographs that we had taken. Actually, this wonderful photographer, she got a female praying mantis and a male praying mantis and took a series of pictures. Somehow, I don't know how she worked it out, but you know, they mated, and then she had a meal, and all that was left was his legs. And we had like a series of six gorgeous photos through the sequence. So I like writing this stuff. Now, that being said, I do also, I do every now and then like to sort of connect to the other parts of the newspaper. So my editor at the Times actually asked me to write about the new outbreak of swine flu this year as it was occurring in the spring. And what I thought was interesting was that actually there were a bunch of evolutionary biologists, people who figure out how things are related to each other, for example, who had sort of swung into action and were taking all sorts of genetic information that was coming in from all over the world from flu strains that were being isolated and sequenced, and to figure out the evolution of this new flu. And they figured out that it was actually already in humans months before the first reports, that it actually spread all over the world before reports in Mexico started emerging. And they also showed that it evolved from a flu that lived in pigs, and showed which flu strain in pigs. So, you know, everybody is talking about the flu, and I can sort of offer kind of this look at the flu from a natural history perspective. So I like to do that too.
Just yes. To follow up on that, like, how often do you have to kind of justify either to an editor or to your readers discussing basic research?
How often do I have to justify discussing basic research to my editors or my readers? Never, I think. Yeah.
Because of the publications you work?
Yeah, I write for places that value basic research. So like the New York Times or National Geographic or Discover. I think what's important is that actually the editors, it's not just that the editors are interested in basic research, but they understand that the readers like basic research. I don't think people really need to be told about some particular application for some piece of scientific research. If it is actually, if it just broadens our understanding of the world, people are curious. I mean, all the people who for example, a few years back were looking at the pictures on Mars from the Mars rover. I mean, there were millions of people who were all looking on the web at the pictures that NASA was supplying. That did not improve any of their lives in any sort of like cholesterol lowering way. It enriched their lives. They wanted to know what was going on Mars just because it's interesting to know what's going on Mars. So, I think that's sort of an underappreciated aspect of writing about science. Yes.
Yeah, I was wondering if you could sort of trace from when you get an idea to the sources that you sort of cultivate, and whether or not you see a need to balance out your articles with your sources. Like,
how do you mean balance with the sources?
Like, do you find contrary opinions or contrasting opinions or contrasting sources? Do you see a need for that when you're presenting basic science research?
Okay, so the question is, do I need to balance different sources when presenting basic research? Very often, yes. Especially if it's especially if you've got a subject that is being debated scientifically. If I'm going to write about plate tectonics, I'm not going to go to the president of the Flat Earth Society for a quote. But you know, I will talk to different geologists who might see different kinds of processes in plate tectonics being more important than others, and you know, so if the state of the science is that there's a debate about this, then that's what I'm going to write about. It's a tricky thing to balance because, you know, it takes a lot of room to explain some science. It's fairly complicated. So how much of the limited space you have do you set aside for people to comment on the science you're writing about or to sort of cast in a debate? And so I just decide on it on a case-by-case basis. Sometimes there'll be very polarized opinions about things, and you have to show that. So there was some research that was done recently, published, suggesting that Komodo dragons, the giant lizards, are actually venomous. They're actually closely related to snakes, and so an evolutionary biologist was arguing that venom actually evolved in the common ancestor, and that Komodo dragons are still venomous, so that when they bite animals, they're actually using venom to help kill them. And I, you know, got comments from people saying this is really good work, and this I think he's right. And then somebody who said that this is totally irresponsible, and you know, I mean, when a Komodo dragon you know, rips your guts out, you know, you're going to fall over. You don't need venom to die. So I put that in there because that's the state of the debate. That's where things are. There are other cases where I really tend to just focus on one person if it's like a particularly interesting person, and through their story I can talk about an area of research. So I came across a review by a scientist named Sarah Lewis at Tufts who works on fireflies, and sort of like praying mantises in the garden. I mean, everybody knows about fireflies. Everyone's curious. She does all these beautiful experiments to show how the pattern of the flash is the product of evolution, of sexual selection, of males advertising to females, but also males having to be careful because there are predatory fireflies who are going to attack them if they're too easy to spot. And so I wrote a piece for the Times about just what she does. I mean, what kind of... So we went into her study site, which was a field in Massachusetts, and she would just show me, you know, all these... You know, there were like 6 different species in this one field, and she could point them out to me and teach me about this language that they were all speaking. And she even had like a little pen light, and she would say, okay, now this is... You're here. We're going to talk to, you know, the females of this species. We're going to pretend to be males. And here's what you do. You know, you go click, click, pause, click, click, and wait. And this little female sitting on the grass flashed in response. That's the kind of work that she does. And it's very simple, but really elegant. And so there, I'm, you know, it's not a sort of casting it as a debate really isn't appropriate, because that's just not the nature of the subject. Yes.
If there's like a really exciting new study coming along, do people approach you, or how do you find out about that? Is it like relationships that you've already developed? Or?
So the question is, when there's an exciting new study coming up, do people approach me, or how do I find out about them? Lots of different ways. So there are people who are really good scientists, and I write about them, and I say, look, when you take the next step in this research, I want to hear about it. And actually that happened here yesterday. Somebody I wrote about in the Times said, well, here's the next paper in this. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to write about this. Thank you. You know, 2 or 3 years later. In other cases, you find out about them because they're press releases that come out either from journals or from universities. Then in other cases, you find out about them just sort of, there's, you know, someone says, oh man, you should check this paper out. This is, you would like this. Unfortunately, sometimes you find out about really exciting papers after they come out, sometimes months afterwards. It's kind of frustrating. Yes?
Is there any crossover now between what you're doing and Andrew Refkin, given the impact of climate science on evolution?
Oh yeah, yeah, absolutely. So Andy Repkin is a staff writer at the New York Times, and his big focus is the environment, and in particular climate change. And he's been doing really wonderful work for years now. Really, perhaps the leading writer on climate change in the United States. Unfortunately, we're at the point now where climate change is affecting everything. And so when I'm writing about evolution or natural history, I'm writing about it on a warming planet. And so so I wrote for the Times a piece about the fact that species are starting to move. So animals and plants are shifting their ranges to places that are have the right climate conditions that they used to have in other places before. So there's some species that are moving north, some species that are moving up mountainsides, and you can really track them now. You can see this is an overall trend. And there's, so I wrote in the Times about this quandary that, you know, some of these animals and plants are going to be able to move, but some of them are not going to, they'll be able to move and therefore survive, but some are not going to be able to move fast enough. So that in 50 years, they're just not, they're, where they end up in 50 years will just not be a suitable place for them to survive. And they're not going to be able to adapt fast enough. And so they may become much more vulnerable to extinction. And there have been some estimates that, very debated estimates, but some estimates of like 30% of all species could become endangered with extinction just because of this effect in the next 100 years. So I wrote about this idea that some people have been proposing of moving things, picking up plants and animals and finding a place where they're going to be able to survive. It's called, it used to be called assisted migration, and now they've, I forget the new term they're using. But it's a very controversial idea, but, you know, when you're writing about natural history, that's what you have to write about. Ocean acidification, you know, I've written about that for places like Science Magazine. I mean, that is having a huge effect on life in the ocean, and it's going to have an even bigger effect in the future. In terms of the things that I write about, you know, I am focusing more on the responses of life to climate change. Andy focuses on sort of the overall research on the atmosphere, on, you know, sea ice in the Arctic. I mean, he's been to the North Pole, and so that's sort of his focus. But I should say that he's been doing really fascinating stuff with blogs at the New York Times. So he's got this blog called Dot Earth, which is where he is just experimenting and trying to see how this new medium can work, and getting into discussions with his commenters and using video, and not just interested in like the results of studies on climate change, which is important, but also trying to think about what kind of strategies might or might not work to adapt to control or climate change or adapt to it. So it's really interesting work he does. Yes, Nicole?
I wanted to ask that, it's quite funny, is that someone once said to me that climate change is only a problem if it goes faster than a squirrel can run. not entirely true, but quite funny. I just wanted to ask you, you work obviously across a wide range of media. Do you have a favorite or most profitable media that you work for? I don't mean organization, I mean type of media, like blog versus. And do you ever find that if you are pitching stories across all these different things and across all these different places, that you sometimes annoy one editor by pitching to Scientific American what Discover might have liked to
learn? Yeah, I mean, you do have to be mindful about that. You don't want an editor saying, you should come to us with that. You know, you don't want, I mean, you want people to sort of feel that they have a relationship with you, and that the kinds of things that you've given them in the past, you will be able to supply them with in the future. That helps to establish and maintain long-term relationships, I find. In terms of the different media, you know, I really need to buy one of those computer programs where you just, I guess lawyers use it, where they punch in and punch out exactly on different projects to figure out exactly how long they're doing work for each client. I have no idea. It's a total blur to me. It really is. I mean, I think this sort of multitasking, attention deficit disorder kind of mindset we all have, I really have it badly. And you know, I'll have like a whole bunch of windows open on my computer, and, you know, and I'll just switch back and forth very quickly, and it's probably not a good idea. I mean, I actually am now trying to like use programs that cut you off from the internet so that I can really focus on one project. that's important, and that's something I need to work on. But, you know, you are juggling all these different projects in these different kind of formats. It's inevitably going to be tricky. I find them all complementary. So it's not like there's one around which all the others are arrayed. So books are still very deeply satisfying to me, and I think that they can have a very deep effect on readers because they're books, because you're with someone for 300 pages and they get done with it and it's going to stick with them. And that's a wonderful thing. That being said, when I'm done with a book, when I'm sort of towards the end of working on a book, you know, there's a few months there where I'm just like, I'm just doing the book, and it's just really getting hard, and I'm just getting really anxious about being able to turn it in a format I'm proud of. And I'm trying to think of this whole 300-page monster and all the parts and making sure they all fit together. And then it's done. And then a blog post or a 500-word article is just such a delight. It's just wonder. It's just like a light breeze or something. You know? And so they balance. And these things balance in other ways, in actually very sort of practical financial ways. So one thing that was interesting to me when I started working on my blog, I was just doing it just for myself, but I would meet, after a while, as the blog became more popular, it's not that popular, but still, it was just gradually getting a bit more popular, and I would meet editors, magazine editors, for the first time, and they knew me, and they knew me fairly often through my blog. So I could tell that magazine editors were going to blogs to themselves to look for ideas. And actually that became really sort of made it easier for me to get assignments from them, because it helped to make me kind of more of a known quantity, because I was just trying to post something every day or two at least. So I'm just there all the time. If something comes up that is, if some news comes up and it relates to a book that I've written, I am not above, you know, writing a post that talks about the new development and then gives a little context from my book. That gets people familiar with my book, and then maybe, you know, somebody might want to buy a copy. So what works for me, at least, is thinking of all these things as an interconnected system. It's not that I have these multiple personalities. It's all of a piece. It's just writing in, but just writing in slightly different styles. Yes.
No, there was a really interesting piece you wrote, but I can't remember the title right now. It was about patients in a vegetative state using fMRI and stuff like that. That was great, by the way. I was wondering, like, there's all sorts of ethical implications and stuff like that.
You know?
And I'm wondering, at what point do you feel like your duty is to sort of bring that to the reader, like, bring the implications of these sorts of technologies to your audience? Like, do you feel a duty to educate them on these issues at all? Or are you still just sort of presenting interesting material?
So the question was about an article I wrote about people in vegetative states, persistent vegetative states, or minimally conscious states. So you get a head injury, you go into a coma, and then you come out of the coma and you might enter into one of these states. Persistent vegetative state is just where there's just no sign of consciousness. Minimally conscious state is where you might sometimes show very slight signs of consciousness, but you can't communicate, you can't do anything. You're just lying there with your eyes open. And so there are these neuroscientists who are trying to figure out what's going on in there. And they're doing fMRI on these people, and since then they've been using what they've learned to put electrodes into the brains of mentally conscious people to try to kind of ramp up their consciousness. So it's a huge, huge minefield of ethics in a lot of different ways. And it was hard for me. I really struggled with that because because there's so many debates about what to do with people who are just in a persistent vegetative state and who have who have not left a living will, saying whether they want to be hooked up to all these machines. So Terry Schiavo was an example of that. That happened after I wrote this article, but that was in a case where, it was just an ethical nightmare because people were fighting over what to do about her. I think that sometimes trying to get into all the ethics surrounding an issue is a bad idea because they each really deserve their own article in a sense. And if you try to just sort of wedge those issues into an article like that one, which was really fundamentally about trying to figure out what's going on in the minds of people in these states, is just going to be a huge distraction, and it's not going to be productive. That being said, there are ethical issues that do come up that are central to an article like that. For example, why is it that there are hundreds of thousands of people in the United States alone in these conditions, and yet there had been just about zero work of this sort that had been done on them? I mean, that's another ethical question. That's kind of shameful that everyone's just sort of left these people to rot, effectively, in these various homes without trying to figure out what's the nature of their injury, how those injuries affect their consciousness, finding more reliable ways to measure their consciousness. So that is something that I did talk about, because that was central to the particular angle I was getting there. I mean, when I write, and I say this a lot when I'm teaching, is that one of the most important things to do is to try to figure out how little you can get away with writing. because if you try to write about everything in a subject, you're dead. I had like 3,000, 4,000 words to write about all that stuff about vegetative state. If I got into that stuff and everything else that swirls around this, it would have been a horrible article, a really bad one. And I think that's true across the board. It's amazing how far you really have to narrow down your focus to find an article that's really going to work effectively. And it's not that you're ignoring other things, it's just that that's not what your article's about.
Can I follow up?
Yep, sure.
How do you find the difference between covering like an interesting natural history story to jumping into like the medical realm?
So the question is, how do I find, I'm sorry, natural history versus medicine?
Versus like medicine, do you find them like drastically different? Do you take the same approach, or do you?
The medical world is kind of it's kind of a weird world. I mean, it's big, and there's a lot of money involved. Sometimes there's a whole lot of ego involved. And in particular, like the methods that are used in the medical world to do research are a little different than the methods that are used in the world of natural history of evolutionary biology, and yet they do come together in surprising ways. And so I tend to back into medical stories just because I'm interested in something, and then lo and behold, it's actually really important for understanding something that's medical. So there's a lot of research that evolutionary biologists have done about the fact that you have genes, some genes from your mother that are turned off, and the corresponding genes from your father are active. And then the verse is also true, that some of your genes from your father are turned off and some of your mother's genes are active. So actually, so if you inherit a mutant copy of a gene from one of your parents, it can actually have a very different effect on you than if you inherited that mutant copy from the other parent. Because it depends on which one was on and which one was off. So this is called imprinting, and it's a really puzzling evolutionary question. Like, why would this happen? And there have been some beautiful studies that have shown that actually it's in a sense kind of an evolutionary conflict between males and females that's being played out in their offspring by which genes are turned on and turned off, because babies make huge demands on their mothers. And really what's happening is that the father's genes are trying to like speed up how many resources are being extracted from the mother, and the mother's genes are actually slowing that down. And there's actually a huge amount of research now that really supports this idea. So this is like a basic, pure evolution kind of idea. And you find it applies to mammals. It actually applies to plants as well, believe it or not. But then some scientists started looking at disorders of gene imprinting, medical disorders. So when the imprinting gets a little screwy, what happens? And it turns out that there are a lot of strange conditions that happen. So, for example, if there are mutations to the father's genes in these gene imprinting disorders, sometimes you'll get babies with syndromes where they develop very slowly and very poorly inside the mother, and then that causes serious problems for them later on. Conversely, there are cases where babies actually grow too fast, and there's a very disorganized growth that happens because of gene problems with gene imprinting. Now, that wouldn't make sense. Let me put it this way. The evolutionary history actually helps you to understand what's going on with this medical disorder. So I've written about this in the Times, for example, that your mother and your father are sort of playing this tug of war with your genes, and if there's a mutation, in a sense, what happens is that one side lets go and the other side pulls way too far to the other side. And so you get these growth disorders that otherwise would be very mysterious. But I really like those examples where actually, natural history can really tell you about very concrete medical disorders. I find that very satisfying. Yeah?
I want to ask a fun question. Uh-huh. Not that these weren't fun.
Sorry, I got way down in the weeds there with the gene imprinting.
I saw your gallery of all the tattoos that scientists get.
Uh-huh.
I saw a few of them, then my internet connection. Anyway, that's another story. So I was just wondering which tattoo you found most interesting, or if you can talk about those kinds of projects. I mean, you've written about zombie cockroaches. Like, there's so many interesting little things that you've done. So, I don't know, but the tattoos caught my attention.
So the story of the tattoos is just another example of how you can just use blogs to just try out things and to let them go in unexpected directions. So I saw. A friend of mine was in a pool with his kids, and he's a geneticist. And I noticed that he had a DNA tattoo on his shoulder. A geneticist DNA. Oh, that's interesting. And I asked him about it, and he said, actually, it spells my wife's initials in the genetic code. Wow. Real geek here, but anyway, so then I took a picture of it because I had recalled that there are other scientists who I've seen like a little tattoo sneaking out under this sleeve, and you know I knew that there are some other scientists who have tattoos of their science, and so I put it on my blog, the little picture, and said, so how many scientists have tattoos, does nobody have a science tattoo? And there are a lot of people out there who have been waiting for someone to ask that question. This was about 2 years ago now. I started getting flooded with tattoos. From scientists, sometimes just science lovers who just have incredibly elaborate tattoos having to do with science, some science or another. I all of a sudden didn't quite know what to do with all this. I mean, I started posting some of them, but then they kept coming, and how do I organize this? Fortunately, blog software is very powerful and versatile. You can just set up a gallery. So every time I receive a new tattoo that I want to put on the blog, I put a post up, and it gets put in the gallery as well, so people just go through it. It's hard to pick one that I really like. I mean,
just some highlights. And
yeah. Well, there's one woman who decided to become a neuroscientist because I believe her father developed Lou Gehrig's disease, and she got a tattoo of the neuron that is primarily affected, the target of the disease. It's on her foot, and so she, this really sums up what her life has become. It's quite powerful sometimes, quite artistic the way that these images can actually sum up somebody's passion. And the way that they throw themselves into their research. I mean, that's something that I try to get across in some of my articles, that scientists are incredibly passionate people. I mean, how else would you spend 6 or 7 years on a PhD and with some worrisome prospects about your job down the line? I mean, you really have to love it. And in some cases, enough to get a tattoo. I ask people to tell me the story behind the tattoo, to get into the science a bit and in their own words. The most recent one I put up was a postdoc who's a developmental biologist, who is also very interested in evolution, and she's Turkish, and Turkey is grappling with a lot of creationism these days. She has been translating a large evolution website into Turkish and putting it up there to doing her part. And she's got engraved tattoos that are based on Darwin's engravings of finches, what came to be known as Darwin's finches, sort of arrayed on her shoulder on the back, quite a beautiful pattern. So all of a sudden, you're learning about dealing with creationism in Turkey through someone's tattoo. I've learned a lot of things about science from people's tattoos in areas.
Do you have any science tattoos?
I do not. I do not have any tattoos. I have no plans of getting them. I don't. The whole process just seems very unpleasant to me. But then again, I'm not a scientist, so I just observe. Been spun. That's interesting. Maybe I'm conveniently forgetting, but I can't think of a case where I was spun to the point that an article that I published is something that I really regret now. But certainly I will get into conversations with people where they, one way or another, really want me to think that their own research is really fantastic, or they want me to agree with that, with their view in a debate, and if I even talk to the people on the other side of the debate, then I'm an idiot. I get that a lot. And I'm talking about scientific debates. if that's spinning, that certainly happens a lot for me. And so the challenge is to just sort of keep a bit of distance, because you know, these are scientists, these are people who know a whole lot about their particular subject, and I respect that deeply, and I learn a lot from these people. But I also have to bear in mind that not everyone may agree with them, that there actually might be a big debate, or actually this person is like the only person in their community, in their specialty, that really thinks this way. So you always have to bear that in mind, and you always have to remember that those scientists won't always tell you about the other people who don't agree with them. They'll conveniently leave that out. And so that is an important thing to bear in mind, definitely.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thanks.
That concludes this School of Journalism podcast. Stay tuned for our upcoming podcasts.